Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Craig, as always, but especially this week, I greatly enjoyed the Florida Phoenix column because it focused on Jacksonville, just 35 miles south of me on Amelia Island, and a town that is a great deal different olfactory than it was 40 years ago.
Yeah, that was not a welcome to Florida people enjoyed when they first got to Jacksonville. Between the 1930s and the 1990s, the place just reeked. It just smelled bad. And kids used to joke that, hey, now we have proof of where the armpit of the universe is. It's Jacksonville, because the place smelled so bad primarily because of the paper mills that were mm-hmm. operating there, but also there were some chemical plants and the city sewer plant. And would just blanket the place with horrible
I mean,
odor.
Just that acrid burn your nose. And, you know, if anyone has smelled paper mill and if you're old enough, you probably have, because, you know, all along the really, you know, Florida, Mobile, you know, Amelia Island had paper mills with that terrible, terrible smell
for Port a long St. time. Joe, Pensacola. Yeah. Yeah.
You get one whiff of that on a bad day and you will never forget it. I assure you of that. When I was going to school and at Auburn, and I had a girlfriend who lived in Mobile, I went down to visit her and got out of the car and I was like, oh, I mean, it is chemical. It is noxious. It is a smell that worse, is.
Yeah. Oh. It's worse than running over a skunk on a country road.
By a long shot. Anyway,
so, we were going to Jacksonville and my wife mentioned it. Oh, it smells so much better now. I went, wow, I had completely forgotten about that because it's been so clean, you know, since the 90s. And so mm-hmm. I got curious about how did Jacksonville get rid of that stigma of being the stinkiest town in America. And it took some interesting combination of things that they needed to have people getting fed up with it. I mean, they'd put up with it for 60 years and it was mostly blue collar neighborhoods that suffered from this, not where the wealthy people lived. There was scientific research that found that there were human health consequences.
Well, you dropped a little tidbit in the story that, what was it, between 1970 and 1975, Jacksonville had the highest incidence of lung cancer in America?
Yeah, yeah.
You think a coincidence?
Of course not. And the people in charge were like, yeah, well, you know.
Jobs. Because that's always the thing. And boy, you use the quote that the people here on Amelia Island used to continually defend the paper mill and Rayonier, this horrible lumber company. Oh, it smells like money.
Yeah,
it smells like money. You know what? No, it smells like lung cancer. It smells like emphysema. It smells literally like death, because literally what came out of those smokestacks killed people.
Yeah. And so you had this hard hitting investigative report that was put out by the local TV station mm-hmm. called The Smell of Money, that really brought it all home for people and said, look, this is causing human health consequences. And they interviewed the people in charge who were just very cavalier about it. And they didn't care. And
they didn't. Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, that whole money argument, and you bring this up all the time. Yes, the paper mill made money and it was important, you know, tax revenue and jobs mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. But what was the other side of that? You mentioned how many businesses, business developers, prospective businesses set foot in Jacksonville thinking, well, should we move our business here? Took one smell of that and turned tail and ran. What was the effect on healthcare costs, on, you know, driving down housing prices? Yes, you can look at it for the jobs it did create, but how much economic development, if we only want to look at it through that specific lens, did it deter?
Yeah. Exactly. And so then one other piece of the puzzle that needed was a champion, a guy who would come in, or a mm-hmm. woman who would come in and say, we have to stop this. And it was Tommy Hazuri, this very unlikely character, this Arab American politician with an acerbic wit and a really bad toupee. But he ran on the platform of I'm going to convert Jacksonville into a world-class city because we're going to get rid of this stink and we're going to have the sweet smell of success. And it worked. And he only served one term because the people in charge didn't like him doing that, but he got rid of the smell and it never came back.
Yeah. And while you're writing about this, you had a Sun move up there. That's wonderful. I hope he enjoys it. But also against the backdrop of the blue-green algae, the toxic water crisis in Florida, an example of, you know, there are environmental disasters fueled by industry in Florida's history, but there is also a model for recovering from them.
Yeah, exactly. And so the parallel I was trying to make is we've got this ongoing problem now with toxic blue-green algae blooms that are popping up all over the place. We, you know, and people are really upset about them. They want them to stop. We've got scientific research showing that it's not just bad for marine life. It's bad for humans. It's bad for our lungs. It's bad for the human health. What we need, and we've had a lot of hard-hitting investigative reporting about it. Most recently, the New York Times did a big spread on Florida's toxic algae blooms. Mm-hmm. We need a champion. We haven't had that yet. We need a Tommy Hazzori.
to say the very, very least. We've got a number of episodes about Jacksonville in the archives, the Ed Ball episode, a number of episodes about clean water, the aquifer, blue-green algae, red tide, that kind of stuff. Check those out and do check out Craig's column, floridaphoenix.com. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as I do each and every week. As we record this episode, Hurricane Idalia has just passed through Florida. The greatest impacts were in the Big Bend area, but if you were able to escape the hand of doom once again, don't continue to play that game. Contact our folks at Windstorm Products. Go to windstormproducts.com. They are the largest online retailer of hurricane hardware, the bolts and screws and nuts and all the stuff that you can use to secure your home from hurricane wind damage. It's a Florida company. They've also got that 800 number up there in the right-hand corner of the website. And that's what I suggest you do. Give them a call. Say, hey, you know, like me, if you live in Fernandina Beach or Vero or, you know, wherever you happen to live, if you're by the water, say, this is my situation. Here's, you know, what my house is like. Here's what it's built out of. I'm worried about this, that, and the other thing. Here's my experience during hurricanes. This is a problem, but that's not. They have the expertise along with the materials to help you out. Windstormproducts.com. And just south of Jacksonville, Craig, is St. Augustine, and that's where we take the podcast today.
Yes, and specifically to Castillo de San Marcos, this very interesting and I think beautiful fort that was built there in the 1600s and is still standing today. You can go visit. I encourage you to go visit. It's quite an amazing structure. Mm-hmm.
It is a top tourist attraction in the St. Augustine area, right there near the downtown. You can't miss it. Our guest is Susan Richburg Parker. She is a colonial historian with a specialty in the Spanish presence in the Southeast, which of course included Florida, former professor at UF and USF. And Susan joins us on the show today.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This is going to be a real treat. Let me ask you a really dumb question first. Is the Castillo the oldest building in Florida?
Oh, I don't usually get it asked that way. The Castillo is possibly the oldest building in Florida, and it is the oldest masonry fort in the 50 states of the U.S.
Wow.
So it's been there almost, let me do the math, 350 years.
Has it been altered or you know, adjusted in any way since it was first built?
Well, you know, when something's been around a long time, I could say that it was enlarged about 250 years ago. So it was altered from the original. It was enlarged around in the 1740s. Since then, it's been largely just maintained.
What was it originally built for?
It was built to be a castle. And I'm going to use the term castle because St. Augustine had 9 forts before the one that's standing today was built. They burned, they rotted, they were all of wood. This one is made of coquina, the local shellstone, which appears on the east coast of Florida from about St. Augustine down into Cuba, I understand, you know, off and on. But coquina is a generic word for little tiny shells. So it was built really to hold off European invaders. They were not so much worried about the Native Americans. It's built with the idea of Europeans fighting Europeans. They all read the same books. They all had the same style. I mean, you know, it was very, very scheduled type warfare. Everybody knew how they were going to set up their armies and where they would put in place their guns and things like that. but it was never just, it did its job, because although it was under siege, a big siege once and other twice, two other times, it was never taken.
And did someone live there?
No, it was not. It was not a place to live. Well, it's called a castle. Let me go back. It's called a castle, actually, Castillo, because its intention is to take in the townspeople during time of attack. So it wasn't just for defense. Obviously, it was for defense. And so most of the rooms in the Castillo, the fortress, held, of course, they held gunpowder and things like that. But they also held, ideally, supplies for people if they needed to come in. Now, of course, imagine damp Florida with flour in wooden barrels in a building made out of shell stone. So most of the time, I'm not so sure how good the supplies were, but that was the intent. It wasn't just to defend. It was to provide shelter for the townspeople. And in 1702, the English from Carolina did attack. They came into the town, and 1,500 residents of St. Augustine went into the fort inside the Castillo and stayed there for 6 weeks. I can't imagine. Wow. Yeah, 1,500 people for 6 weeks. Surely supplies must have been running. Of course, they were ordered to bring in all their own supplies, and they brought in wood and other things like that to make temporary shelters.
Livestock? Did they bring in livestock too?
the livestock mostly they kept close to the walls. They didn't bring the livestock in so much. There were several wells inside the fort. But I can't imagine how hot the tempers must have been from time to time, that many people close together. And there were three babies born while they were in there.
So other things besides tempers. Yeah, babies are gonna come with babies.
They don't care if there's a war going on.
But surely the site must have been larger than the tourist attraction today. At that 1,500 people, I mean, it's just on a map, or maybe it isn't. You know, how much larger was it at that time?
It's the size. It's the size it's always been. It's just, when I said it was enlarged, parts of it were enlarged, but the outline of it is what it's been since the 1670s.
Wow. Oh, my God. There were 1,500 people in there.
Well, that's how many people came in from the town. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I can only go by the reports written at the time.
And that was in addition to the soldiers already there.
No, the soldiers were counted.
Okay.
The soldiers lived in the town with their family.
Oh, okay.
They stayed at the fort. They were usually on duty, kind of like firemen, you know, on for 24 hours or something like that. And so they had small, wouldn't even call it a barrack, but they had small sleeping places and places for them to cook when they were on duty. But they did not, the intent was not for them to live there. Sometimes it happened.
Gotcha. You mentioned about the Coquina construction. Was that the first fort castle that the Spanish had built out of Coquina?
Out of the Coquina here, I'm not sure what they used, because I'm not, what they used in San Juan for El Morro. Which is also a masonry fort. They probably use some sort of local stone. And if you look at, you know, if you look at the Castillo in St. Augustine, it's a smaller version of the one in San Juan and the one in Havana. They all, like I said, they all had the same plans. You know, they all sort of built the same things to look alike, kind of a four-pointed star with watchtowers at each end. And the one in St. Augustine has a very large watchtower on the side that faces out to the sea.
I guess what I'm getting at, though, is the Coquina is a sort of a unique building material. What sort of, how good a defense did it provide?
Well, you know, actually the fort was never tested very much as far as defense went. They tried to lob, you know, the idea was to set up your mortars and your artillery and lob the cannonballs over into the walls. Some of them hit the walls, but the walls never really, walls were never shattered or broken. Coquina is very porous. It's a little bit below the surface here, probably about 6 or 7 feet down. And then it dries when it comes out, but it's very soft below the surface. It's just, you know, a bazillion little seashells all over the millennia, sort of concreted together. The most interesting thing, I think, one of the most interesting things about the fort is the most damage that was done to it was probably about 8 or 9 years ago when a pickup truck being driven by someone who had had too much to drink.
Oh, no.
went out of control and never, it did not hit the fort walls itself, but it did hit some of the moat retaining walls around it. So, you know, after all that firepower, all that international rivalry.
Well, the reason I keep pursuing the coquina thing, I had read in a park brochure that I guess if it had been a standard concrete, it might have shattered with the bombardment. But because the coquina is soft and is porous, some of the cannonballs actually just bounced off.
Pretty much. Actually, there's a professor at the University of Florida who's been doing some tests with that as to how much coquina repels or doesn't suck up the cannonballs. But for the most part, the cannonballs didn't hit. You know, that the precision just wasn't there. They were firing from quite a distance offshore. They were firing off ships, so it really was never hit that much.
How, and coquina is interesting, the other coquina forts tell similar stories. You'd think these are seashells and it would be incredibly fragile and cannonballs and anything would you know, just pass right through it. But it acts almost like a sponge in a sense, or, you know, it sort of absorbs the blows as opposed to fracturing or breaking. So it is a really interesting building material. How large was the Spanish garrison presence, troop presence, military presence there at the peak?
At the peak, there's always how many were, you know, supposed to be here. And then the reports, as with any government reports, whether it's 2023 or whether it's, you know, 300 odd years ago, they're always at odds with each other. But around 300 soldiers. Okay. And most of them had their families here as well. So it was like a military base. St. Augustine was a military base, just like a naval air station or an army fort today.
Right. And the purpose was to defend Spanish Florida and continue its colonial ambitions on the continent?
To defend Spain, and especially to be close to the Gulf Stream. Because the Spanish fleets used the Gulf Stream to go back to Europe. They would come out of Havana, where they all would congregate in Havana from Mexico. They would have brought some items across the Isthmus of Panama. So they would all converge in Havana which was probably not a very good plan for a once a year fleet. So it was kind of an all or nothing. And the Gulf Stream is about 60 miles offshore here at St. Augustine, much closer in southern Florida, but keeps the boats out in deep water. And so the idea was to also to defend the Gulf Stream and to keep someone else from having it. Not the Gulf Stream, but to close to the proximity.
The fort is very northern Florida, St. Augustine, which of course is placed there on purpose because the British, just across what is the modern day border of Florida, controlled the territory north. How was that dividing line determined, that, you know, Florida, again, what we say is modern, you know, current day Florida is south, and that was Spanish, and then the British had the north? How was that initial set?
The Spanish were in St. Augustine 100 years before the British, 50 years before the British set up Jamestown. So they were here. And one of the reasons they went as far north as Virginia is because the Spanish were down in Florida and they did not want to have a contest with them. And then, of course, South Carolina is established just about 100 years after St. Augustine is settled. And, of course, what we have is overlapping claims. I mean, the Spanish originally, when people really didn't know everything, they claimed all the way up to Nova Scotia, as far west as they knew the land went early on. And, of course, that gets pared down. The British, when they established South Carolina, claimed that their claims go all the way to New Smyrna. You know, so it's the old, here's what I claim, but here's what I hold. And what I hold is usually the bigger issue.
Yeah, possessions 9/10 of the law.
Right, so right. Yeah. No matter where you are.
Yeah. There's a fascinating history that exists with that British-Spanish tension trying to colonize North America, and a fascinating history as it relates to slavery and St. Augustine in a way being the initial underground railroad with enslaved populations in the Carolinas. Flesh out a little bit of that history of
Well, the Spanish, no, the Spanish had slaves from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. They brought their own slaves with them. And so they did have slaves that worked from the initial settlement in 1565 forward. When the British arrived in South Carolina, about 100 years later, they, of course, brought slaves with them. And these, I'm making it very simplified here, mm-hmm. but the slaves decided they perhaps they could find freedom in Spanish Florida. There had already been white indentured servants that had run away from South Carolina and had been freed in Florida. So they had some reason to believe this might happen. And so they set out. Some of them were permitted to stay. Others were sent back to Carolina. Some had to stay and serve like sort of a servitude period. A lot of it depended on the international relationships between Spain and England, because Spain and England were often at each other's throats in Europe, and they didn't want to go to war over something as minor as Carolina or Florida. Anyway, the slaves did run away, and if they stayed, just like anybody else who came into Spanish Florida, if they stayed and became a resident, they had to become Catholic. And so they were baptized. In fact, it's interesting that you ask, because I'm actually writing an article about that right now. The first slaves that we know of that were permitted to stay came 1687, about 17 years after Carolina was founded. And they first landed at Amelia Island, at a mission there. But by then they were in Spanish territory. It's sort of like you think about the other refugees that come to Florida from the other direction. Now they want to be able to be in U.S. territory and get off the boat. Well, that's basically what those slaves did 300 years ago. They got out of their canoe after they had wound their way down through the tidal creeks from, I'm not sure where in South Carolina, to Amelia Island. There was a mission, a Spanish mission there. They stayed there for a while and then came to St. Augustine, and then started the diplomacy back and forth between the English and the Spanish, because the English wanted their slaves back. The Spanish said, well, maybe we'll buy them from you. And all this debate went back and forth. Eventually, those slaves were permitted to stay. The documents say that they promised to pay for them, and I'm still looking for where they paid the English for them.
If you don't mind my taking a little side trip here, Craig, I want to ask you, Susan, about Fort Mose, which is a smaller fort just north of St. Augustine. And by just north, I mean, you know, a couple of miles. I had a chance to visit there earlier this summer. And Fort Mose has an interesting history as, you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, but is the first African-American settlement in North America.
It's the first free black town.
Okay.
Wow.
You know, because like I said, there were and although the I want to clarify that, because people get a misunderstanding. Although the slaves came from Carolina and were freed sometimes, the Spanish continued to have slaves of their own. They always had slaves here until slavery was eliminated by Spain way into the 1800s. But Mose was established on the perimeter of the town, really to be a small fort to intercede by any of the British that were trying to come from Carolina. And so these were people that had run away from the Carolinas. They had come to St. Augustine and were freed, and they had the most to lose if the British were successful and captured mm-hmm. and captured the fort. So Fort Mose, or the Mose Village, really, it was a village with a little fort, which you said you read earlier, was established in 1738 and only lasted about a year initially, because the British threat was so strong that the governor of Florida brought everybody into St. Augustine because he was afraid that they wouldn't be able to withstand any attack. It's reestablished about 12 years later, and the freed blacks from Carolina go back to live out there.
Tell us also about, there's another nearby Fort Matanzas.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that one, too.
Fort Matanzas is south of St. Augustine, near a very small inlet to the Atlantic Ocean. I think today even years ago, only small boats really can get across that inlet. It's not even maintained by the Army Corps these days. It's so inconsequential, I guess you might say. But Fort Matanzas is a very small little outpost, probably held about 4 to 6 soldiers at the time. And they could stop smaller boats that might try to come into the inlet south of St. Augustine and come up the intracoastal, well, today is the intracoastal waterway, and attack St. Augustine. So it was like, I went there to an event several years ago. It's out on a small island. It was really cool because we were out there by torchlight. And we weren't alone. We had all the bugs and mosquitoes, but just like they did. But it was really cool to be out there. And it felt very isolated.
There is a high school in Florida, in Jacksonville, called Pedro Menendez High School.
St. Augustine.
It is St. Augustine. Okay, mm-hmm. Sorry about that. He is a prominent figure. Who is Pedro Menendez?
Pedro Menendez was the person who settled St. Augustine in 1565, and he had a contract to be the owner, as the Spanish would say. Of course, we're just not even talking about the presence of the Native Americans here.
Yeah,
I want to, you know, I wear the owner idea is very European. Mm-hmm. And so he was to settle, and he thought he would, you know, mine pearls, gold, silver, grow olives. It was, you know, some of it was just the lack of knowledge as to what the Southeast was like, because even though it was pretty much on the same latitude of southern Spain, the climate is very much different.
Yeah, yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, he was involved in a prominent massacre in this history, right?
Right, uh-huh. The French had already established Fort Caroline at Jacksonville, which of course is about 40 odd miles north of St. Augustine. They came down to attack the Spanish as soon as they were literally as they were stepping off the boat.
Wow.
But there was a storm.
Welcome to Florida.
it was early September. There was a storm. They mm-hmm. couldn't get ashore, and they were blown all the way down to the Canaveral area. Wow. And then some of them melted into living with the Indians. Others walked up the beach to try to get back to Fort Caroline, and he encountered them there at Matanzas Inlet near Fort Matanzas, which I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And most of them ran away. Most of them they decided to keep going. They turned around and went south again.
Yeah.
So he did slaughter the ones that were there. They were both, yeah. They were both French, and they were Protestants. So they were considered to be heretics. You know, this was a time of warfare between all those, and, you know, religious wars take no prisoners then yeah. and now.
Matanzas is murder in Spanish?
Killing or slaughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, you know, remember that as you drive past and you see these names and history. It is a violent, violent history. When did...
Well, the French came back and got the Spanish 3 years later. They didn't leave it unanswered.
Yeah. When did the fort's importance militarily begin to wane as technology advanced?
Well, actually, it was out of date when it was built.
Oh, yeah.
like a number of the forts that were built later along the Atlantic coast, the technology had already advanced beyond the forts. Some of the ones in Georgia, the coastal forts, have the same issue that are built later. You know, apparently the cannon that were brought couldn't take it. It's, you know, the thing is, its presence was important. It's everybody that wanted to attack was worried about it. It was kind of the idea, the best offense is a good defense. And so the English tried to attack in 1702. Like I said, everybody went into the fort, but they did not take the fort. They thought they would starve them out, but they got reinforcements from Spanish Cuba. 40 years later, the British try again from Georgia. That didn't work. And then in 1812, the Americans from Georgia try again to seize Florida. And they actually just sort of cut a path around St. Augustine because they're afraid of the fort. They're afraid they can't take the fort. They're afraid of the guns of the fort. Little did they know how badly the climate had the guns would have not performed well, but they didn't know that.
Yeah.
So it was always this large presence that scared everybody, which probably was you know, its reputation was bigger than its performance.
Yeah, it was a deterrent, not a natural threat.
And you wonder how many attacks were never even thought of because of the fort. Yeah. It's like, I just don't even think about that. They've got the fort.
For me, psychologically, it's always difficult to remember that into the 1800s, Florida was not part of the United States. You know, Florida was not one of the 16, you know, one of the original colonies. Because of its Spanish presence. You think, well, Georgia was a colony, South Carolina was a colony, and Florida was settled before
we
all
were
of
two
these
colonies.
So yeah. it is always something I have to consciously think of myself that, you know, into the 1800s, this is Spanish Florida. And I mean, you know, 1800s are obviously a long time ago relative to, you know, my lifetime, but world history not. And it's one of those weird quirks of Florida that most people, you know, lose sight of.
Well, and, you know, as far as the Castillo or the fort goes, it was the U.S. military took it over in 1821 when Florida became a U.S. territory. And then at the beginning of the Civil War, because there were federal troops in St. Augustine, because there was a military already here, they took over the fort. So it still was, I don't think it was seen very much as a real defense concern, but it was a place to store things. And you could see right out the inlet. You could see the inlet and see the ships that were approaching.
What is its legacy then to Florida history?
Well, it's certainly a reminder that the Spanish were in Florida and in the southern part of the U.S. for a long time, not just in Florida. I think it's also we forget how long it's been there. I mean, this is a building that's 350 years old. I don't think they intended for it to last 350 years, but for various reasons it did, and certainly as an active defense installation for 2.5 centuries. So it's a reminder. It also shows us how people used to live, that they lived very, very sparingly, and the type of construction that they did. The shell stone or the coquina that the fort is made of. Also, there are about 30 houses in St. Augustine made of that shell stone as well that were made during the Spanish colonial time. There were many, many more made, but those are the ones that remain standing.
Those have lasted. If you were bringing someone to the fort to show them around, what are some things you'd make sure that they saw? Because it's a great tourist attraction now.
Well, I always like to, and I do that. I always usually take them up on the gun deck first, so they can look out at the ocean. They can get a perspective, and then they can look out at the town and try to imagine it. You know, we were talking about the Mose village earlier. Well, you could see from the gun deck of the Castillo, you could see the little Mose village
really
years ago when they kept all that area cleared of trees and brush. You know, the fort today is a little deceptive because people live near it. There's lovely trees everywhere. But when it was a defense work, you know, they basically had a field of fire around it. And so people didn't build anything there. They'd let them build crops. If you built even the smallest thing, it was understood, you know, it could be demolished at a moment's notice if it was needed for defense reasons. And so it's a great place to start. Interestingly enough, I had actually a reporter come through several years ago that I took around, and she thought it was a hotel.
Is it listed on Airbnb? I don't think it is. I
mean, I'm sure somebody, you know, with enough money could remodel it to make a cool hotel. Boy, would you ever have to do some weatherproofing?
Yeah.
No goodness kidding. Gracious. Well, I can't imagine there's indoor plumbing in there. So you'd be.
There are bathrooms in there.
Are there really? Okay.
I put those bathrooms in. I would guess.
Wow, the Spanish were really ahead of things in their colonial period, huh?
No, I think that was the National Park Service.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. When did it become a unit of the National Park?
Right in the 1920s.
Oh, that early! Wow.
And
okay.
You know, it also has a history. You know, some of the Native Americans that were captured in the Western Wars were brought to the Castillo de San Marcos for imprisonment.
Were they?
Pensacola.
Yeah, that was the Red River War, I believe, like Kiowa, Comanche, Texas Panhandle, Oklahoma. And there's a fascinating history there as well, because a lot of them did what are called ledger drawings, and you can very clearly see the lighthouse.
There's a wonderful book. I don't know that it's for sale anymore, by Herman Viola. that shows their drawings. And it actually, it's an illustration of their trip across the U.S. by train.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not just in St. Augustine.
Right. And these were prison. I've had the very good fortune as an arts writer specializing in Native American art to write about this. And the Kummer Museum in Jacksonville had a fantastic exhibition of this material not too long ago. But these were prisoners of war from the Red River War out on the Great Plains. And then they're shipped to internment, you know, essentially imprisonment in Florida. And I can only imagine in that area or that era, excuse me, you know, coming to this utterly foreign place geographically, climate, you know, what they would have thought. And I'll put some links to this down in the show notes, but here's another chilling legacy of this fort. And I forget the guy's name who was the commander essentially, but
Pratt, I believe.
Excuse me?
Pratt.
Yes, Pratt. It was his idea, the Indian boarding schools, from what he saw with the Native American captives there and this whole idea of kill the Indian, save the man sort of thing. There is a terrible colonial genocidal boarding school history that emanates out of the fort there west to Native America that we haven't even touched on in maybe an episode for down the road sometime.
There was a show on A&E Network years ago about Geronimo. You can also buy it, well, probably as a CD or something now. I mean, I used to use it in my classes. It's about Geronimo, but in it they interview the grandchildren of some of the prisoners that had been at the Castillo. And they interviewed one woman who was very elderly by then, and her grandfather had been there when he was a teenager. He had been sent across the country as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And she just, you know, she's grabbing at reminiscences, and she was talking saying how he used to stand up on the gun deck and watch the waves of the ocean. Because, of course, they were so different.
Yeah.
The West. That seemed to be, you know, she didn't have too much of the other story to tell, but it was.
Was yeah. Geronimo one of the prisoners there?
No, he was not here. Some of his wives were, I believe.
Oh,
he was in Pensacola, I believe, at Fort Pickens there, but not in St. Mm-hmm. Augustine.
Mm-hmm. Was Osceola ever imprisoned there?
Yes, he was. He was really? Captured. He was at the fort here for about 2 months, and from the Castillo, and then it was called Fort Marion at that time.
Fort Marion, that's right. With the Pratt, it was Fort Marion. Okay.
It remained Fort Marion until the National Park Service took it back over and gave it its Spanish name back again.
Well, that would make the United States would want to take the Spanish name off of it and put some sort of American. Yeah, right.
It was named for Francis Marion. And then Osceola was sent, he was already ill. He was sent from St. Augustine to Fort Moultrie in South Carolina, and that's where he died.
All fall into place. Thank you so much for the time today. Susan Richburg is a colonial historian living there in the St. Augustine area. This has been very enlightening to me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, fascinating.
Have a good day. Thank you.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I was mentioning to Susan that earlier it was actually the 4th of July of 2023, or the 3rd or the 5th, I forget which. I did visit Fort Mose just outside of St. Augustine, but I'm a little embarrassed to say, Craig, I've never been to Castillo de San Marcos.
Oh, you should go. You should go. And they actually do a reenactment of the changing of the guard there and fire off cannons and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's very impressive.
Yeah, that the history with Fort Marion, the American name, is something I am familiar with because I've written a lot about the Native American prisoners of war who were mm-hmm. kept there. And again, this is, oh gosh, I want to say 18, probably 60s, 70s, Indian Wars period, that sort of thing. And talking to her also, it's just, it does boggle my mind that Florida was a Spanish territory into the 1800s, mm-hmm. not part of the American Revolution. You know, Florida has kind of gone its own way in that regard on the East Coast.
Well, as Gary Marmino likes to say, the pilgrims who landed in Massachusetts and had such a hard winter, you know, for the first Thanksgiving, if only they'd just come a little further south to St. Augustine, they could have stayed in a hotel, been nice and warm.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.